and welcome to Pomcast, the podcast brought to you by Pom Pom Quarterly. I'm Lydia Gluck, and I'm here with...
Sophie Scott.
You might know that this podcast, this particular episode, will have a slightly different format to our usual lots of Sophie and Lydia chat and small amount of other people chat. We've flipped the ratio somewhat.
Yes, definitely, yeah.
So we're recording this in the past. Ooh.
Ooh, it's recording in the past.
Yes, but even more in the even past more than usual.
Double,
yeah, good point.
Double quota of past, for you, yeah.
Because our wonderful producer is on paternity leave.
Indeed he is.
So give him a little break to have a little baby and stuff. So this is the second instalment of the Knitters in the Round discussions that we recorded at Pomfest, hosted by Anna Maltz.
So this this debate was crafting consciously. So Anna was joined by four leading practitioners. Who were they? They were Clara Parks. You'll know her from her writings about wolves. Mm-hmm. Bristol Ivy. Oh, hey, she's got a book coming out with Pom Pom.
I think it's already out by the time this podcast comes out.
Oh my gosh, yeah. The past. And the future. Julia Billings of Wool and Flower. She sponsored a Pom Pom podcast in the past.
She did.
Yes. And she does lovely naturally dyed yarn. And Julie Asselin, a cool yarn dyeing lady.
Who is in Canada.
Oh, she's also been on the podcast.
She has. God, that's true.
We've got the good guys, haven't we? So all these lovely ladies get around and a table. And are discussing what's the best environmental choices as a knitter that we can make.
Yeah, and they also kind of talk about what it means to them to craft consciously. Mm-hmm. And that term... isn't necessarily one thing. It doesn't have to mean organic, although it can. And there's lots of really interesting thoughts regarding that quite complicated subject.
Yes. So enough about hearing us talk about it.
Yeah. Why not just listen to it?
Yeah. And here you go. Enjoy.
Hello, I'm super excited to be here generally, and especially with this group of women here, to talk about crafting consciously and sort of what that means, what that brings up for each of us in what we choose to do, and really to kind of start very first by saying that will mean something different to each of us. So what we're giving is how we navigate those ideas rather than any hard and fast rule, which if you don't do, it means you're dicking over the planet or, you know, screwing your neighbor or whatever. So it's just sort of how we navigate those things. And these people are here because I know they're very thoughtful people on conscious, like, crafting in different ways. Bristol has earned her chops as a pattern designer working with Brooklyn Tweed, and we know that all of the mathematical, you know, sort of magic that goes on in that brain there. And yesterday, if anybody was here for her talk, what really also came up for me was an idea about the sort of sustainability of inspiration and how you stay interested in what you do and how that translates out from you. Julie Asselin, we know as, you know, bilingual, French-Canadian, effervescent dyer for a really long time, amazing colors, and using synthetic dyes as opposed to Julia Billings over here, who we know as Wool and Flower, who you might see various people with pouches that look like they were made from old tweed coats. And they may well come from this woman here, and they may well have been old tweed coats before. But she also draws on her history from horticulture to do a lot of natural dyeing and being very conscious of where the plants come from and those things. And I think that having these two here together is a really nice way to sort of dispel some of the myths about one of them being better than the other for different things, and that would be a nice conversation. Clara Parks, as we have heard you wonderfully speak today already, kind of feels like, you know, New York Times bestseller. We've heard that whole New York Times bestseller for knitting. And really, I think, you know. And yeah, it's totally time. And it's also time, like, I kind of think about that and all the millions of different ways that you've come up with to say itchy wool. And I just think that your caring voice in that, like the enthusiasm and the excitement for that to diversify the type of yarns that we use and to find value in those things that for a bracket of time were sort of thought of as itchy and scratchy and those things, like that is an incredible act of sort of environmental conscious building in itself. And I think that's why I've got you here. So let's start. And I think from that point of view, like that clarity is that we all come to slightly different angles of crafting consciously. And there are very different ways. There's a political angle of that, whether that's a human rights thing and, you know, the human labor involved in it and what people get paid for what they do, whether it's an environmental concern that could be organic but might not be about being organic. It's finding different names for, you know, there's organic certification, and then there's people who have sheep that you know do really great things with their sheep, but it's never made sense for their farm to be officially certified as that. But if you're feeling comfortable with what they do, is that as good as that? And I think what I'm trying to say is there are all of these different angles, and we can't always be everything. So maybe to talk a little bit about what your particular angle of focus when you talk about conscious crafting, what you mostly think of. And can I start over here?
So for me, conscious crafting is multi-layered in a lot of ways. I think it's very easy to get stymied by the idea of ethical work because there's no right answer. There's no way to do everything perfectly. There's no way to do it all. You'd be sitting in the basement not knitting anything if you weren't able to make concessions somewhere. So for me, the discussion of crafting consciously comes to who can I support? Who's doing good in the world? Who's doing good in their community? Who's doing good to preserve sheep breeds? Who's doing good to open up smaller markets for farmers to make that available? How can I promote them? How can I then use proceeds from those sales to go towards charities who are doing the same things? But then I also know that without the support of my community and the fact that I get yarn support from a lot of these things, I would not be able to use most of the yarn that I want to support. That's just not possible for me. So I also think that there's a very interesting discussion to be had about the privilege of conscious crafting and where that sits in our community and how we can make this discussion available to all socioeconomic classes. So that's something that I definitely like to focus on and want to keep focusing on as part of this community.
Yeah, and it's probably good to sort of think about the fact that most of us here aren't choosing if we'll buy dinner or yarn, or like if we'll eat and have yarn or have a roof over our head and have yarn. So to also know that that is a section of how today that's the group we're in.
Mm-hmm. And I think it ties in a little bit with how we do things. You know, for us being in Canada, and I'm going to say, you know, like, let's say if we go very local, going to Quebec and then trying to work, let's say that we want to try to work with local yarns or something like that, it's not very viable on the, you know, on the size of what we're doing with things. So then for us, like the chain.
You mean in terms of the yarn you would dye, yes, the bases you would
and
use
then,
to dye
on? You know, like there are many things that we need to think about, like who are we working with? Where does it come from? What type of dyes are we using? You know, companies in our areas that we are helping out. You know, also for us, and then that's the question that I wanted to bring in, is, you know, we are a small company, but we are here because there are also bigger ones that, like, makes it possible for us to do things. And then how does it tie in with being conscious and thinking, you know, small, helping out other people? And then does it always mean small? You know, being conscious, does it always mean small things? And,
you mean big in terms of bigger yarn producers who you're then buying from rather than because there are bigger companies, they make you look small?
No, I mean, like, in the terms of, you know, for us to be able to have custom spun yarns and working with mills, and then if there were bigger companies working with them, they wouldn't have any work, so then we wouldn't be able to support them. And then, you know, something else that I was thinking about is, you know, for example, with Nurtured, the yarn that we are producing with Green Mountain Spinnery, when we started working on that, a lot of people were asking us, why aren't you guys doing, like, single breed something very close and all that? But when we were working with the spinnery, I said, you know what, you guys buy yarn, and, you know, we talked together, and we said it would be really good if we were able to, like, chip in all together and make it, like, a bigger thing for you, so then you guys could work, like, on not on a bigger level. I'm not explaining this well, but I mean, like, to chip in with them and, you know, like, to make it easier on them and like to support them in that way. So then we chose to like to use some of the same fibers that they were using to support them, and then we were adding to the blend something that we were bringing in. But then, you know, we decided to work with them to, you have to help me out, people.
Infrastructure.
Yes. All right. So that's what I meant.
Infrastructure.
So that's what I mean. So in the terms of, you know, community, and for us, it's always about family. You know, like, it's a very big thing. And, you know, I see the community as a family, and then I see it as us working together, and then, you know, friendship and all that. So.
Yeah. I think I've really thought about, like, when we talk about local, I think particularly with, like, there's this thing that's come up where, you know, we really like here, it's exciting, like Quince & Co. and Brooklyn Tweed, which have made so much sense in the States because it's more local, even though it's a huge country if you look at it in comparison to the size of Europe, you know, those. So in a way, also maybe running through what we're doing is also a discussion of what local is. And I do think that in this community that we all build together, we make different sorts of local. and that also does become about the people who we choose as family.
That was something that I grappled with at the beginning in Knitter's Review, reviewing yarns from all around the world. And people would say, how can you know, you're not supporting local, you're sending us to France. But for me, it was more like shining light on people who are doing valuable work that has a similar impact to what it would be having in my community. They're maintaining a certain value structure and contribution to their local culture and society and families and economy. And that's, so I have like a global definition of local that's more kind of on a spiritual level, if we're talking yarn spirit. But for me, crafting consciously, it's always been about the materials that you use. Like, just knowing anything that you can about where they came from, who made them, what fibers are in them, how were they processed, how were they spun, how were they dyed, who am I supporting with this? And when I started making yarn myself, and I did a little chart of all the different places that were touched by a single skein of yarn, and it was really moving. It was rather remarkable. And oftentimes you're working with small groups of people who have sort of given up or don't, like, they can't find the market. And it's a simple act on our part to even get one skein of yarn, and yet it has such a big impact. I'm going to quote Bloom County cartoon here. There are limits. So there was this cartoon, you know, a bunch of people in a restaurant, and they said, oh my God, animals are killed. I'm not going to eat meat anymore. And then the next person said, oh, vegetables, they're living too. We're not going to eat them. Oh my God, we can't stand on the floor because we're killing bugs. In the last frame, they're dangling from the ceiling by their feet. And they said, oh no, there are organisms in the air. We're going to kill them. So I feel like there are layers and layers and layers, and it's up to each one of us to choose kind of where we want to slide through that. So, like, I eat meat, and yet I am also deeply disturbed by the killing of animals. So, like, I live in a conflicted area. And
it's like a constant paradox for you.
It's a constant paradox. Yeah, yeah. And the minute that you're like, black or white, I'm not going to knit any merino at all because in Australia they still, in some places, practice mulesing. And so I'm not going to do any wool. I'm going to do recycled plastic because that's, like...
because that comes from dinosaurs.
Exactly. And moss will never eat it. Ugh. So anyway, that's where I kind of fall.
I agree. I think it's a profoundly complex thing, and I think we're constantly changing with it. I think as soon as you start trying to lock even yourself into something, you're going to find new conflicts coming up. And in a way, that should be something fun, that should, you know, something joyful that we see ourselves learning and more and experiencing and talking to people and sharing that, and I think that's a potential for growth. I think for me, a big part of it is about sustaining community and local culture. So, for example, I'm from Australia, and although most people think about Australia as being somewhere that produces huge amounts of wool, we do, but we produce virtually no yarn. So there's very little infrastructure there, and so there's mini mills going on there that are building that, and the local community is slowly getting on board. I mean, it's still very niche, but... things look a certain way on the surface, but when you start to scratch, you see what's missing or what's happening. So I think, yeah, that's particular interest for me.
And maybe something that is an interesting point between the scale of things, the small, because in a way, because there is this growing knitting community who think that's important, those micro mills are starting to pop up in Australia in a way that it was kind of dominated by two big ones until very recently. There wasn't the opportunity of diversity.
Absolutely, definitely. And I think also looking at the size of flocks, and I know you've been in New Zealand, and I think in the States and Canada as well, we have huge flocks in Australia. They're massive. They're millions of head. And looking at how to run that as a sustainable enterprise is very different to having a small flock in Britain somewhere, which is really lovely and where, you know, the shepherd can know each sheep individually. You know, it's just not possible. So how do we do that in a sustainable way? I think that's really interesting and also really challenging.
I'm not sure the scale. I think you were talking about merino and then the flocks that were growing in China as well. Growing in scale of farming rather than like growing out of the ground. I know sheep don't grow on trees or out of the ground. Yeah,
I wish they did. That is a concern. I don't know. It's a paradox. It's always a paradox. Mm. And the market is always shifting. Australia and New Zealand are huge, huge wool producers. But now China has flocks that from some years they produce more wool than Australia. Really? But they have problems with the fiber right now, but they're solvable problems. And that's where I feel like it's even more important for us right now, like we've heard the warning, to build the infrastructure to take the slack when they no longer need our wool, if they stop importing from Australia.
Absolutely.
Or they're the single largest importer of wool from the United States. So, and we actually are in a position, I know that like very high up, the American sheep industry in the US, they had a list of like, what is the hope for wool? Mm-hmm. And right up there was specialty yarn for the hand knitting market. So we're not invisible, we're not at all. So.
Can I ask too, do you know what the current running price is for like a kilo of wool in Australia versus US?
I don't. I get an email every week. I could pull it up on my phone.
You do really?
I do.
Really?
Yes. It's a commodity. It's very cool. And from week to week, it changes depending on. It is a commodity.
It's just slightly larger to store than gold. You know?
Yeah. Slightly. Bit lighter though.
Yeah. Do you want to pull it up?
My phone's on.
I don't know. Should we pull it up now?
I'd be curious because I think I think the place of the farmer is a huge part of the crafting consciously and how much they're getting paid as opposed to the overhead of the production system. Because I know, like, merino yarn coming from when I was in New Zealand, and I think it's the case in the UK here, that it costs more to shear than it did for the fleece itself. Mm-hmm. So there was just not a sustainable market for that. And I'm curious as to whether with the infrastructure going in Australia and with the current stream going from the US to China, whether there is a set rate that makes sense and whether if that changes, if the bottom's going to drop out of that market. And then there needs to be something more sustainable for the farm culture.
Well, it also changes depending on the currency, the exchange mm-hmm. rate. But I can tell you that a fine quality Greece merino wool is currently going for about $5.50 a pound. But then the numbers in this report, they're more like very, very large farms that haven't found the knitters yet. Yes. And so they're getting, for clean wool, I would say it's in the $4 range per pound, which means that's half of the wool. You lost half the weight in scouring it. So they're really getting $2 per pound, which...
Is that like one sheep?
Oh, right, right.
I don't know.
I'm that way with kilos. I'm like, 1 kilo is, I don't know the weight of an elephant.
Like when we're talking about that. Like,
depends on the breed, doesn't it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it depends on the breed. Maybe 12 pounds?
Yeah, I think
or
merino.
8 to 12?
But I think, I think these things of economy, like, it's sort of, it feels super dry, but there are so many ways in which economy just does affect what we do. It also affects, you know, buying when we buy yarn, even at the later stage of it. When you calculate that backwards, like, I think we've gotten a bit more conscious about how much we pay for something that has mm-hmm. gone through a hand dyer. But it's still framed by what's an okay amount to spend on something. But it should probably be even more if we were going to have the knockback effect.
Right, yeah, it's based on the existing market definitely. Rather than on actual livable wages.
Yeah.
And I think it's like that for every craft. You know, like for us, you know, even with customers or with stores, I mean, we have to keep in mind that, like, how much does someone would be willing to pay for something, you know, could we charge more? Definitely. But then you have to keep in mind, like, is it possible for someone to buy it? Is it viable for a store? Is it viable for a knitter? And then you have to keep all of this in mind. And it's slightly connected, but I was just going to say earlier, you know, when we talked about, you know, like local and economy and how you want to do things and all that, you know, recently for us, you know, all our yarns are spun in Canada or the States. And then the mill that we work with in Canada is the only worsted weight one. There's like only one is the only one. And, you know, like recently working with them, we work closely and we go and we visit them and all that. And we started questioning, you know, it's close to us. And then recently we started questioning if we still wanted to work with them, not because, well, so it's local, but then we're not necessarily, agreeing with not like work practice. It's not like they're not paying their employees or anything, but I
child
mean,
labor.
You know, like for us also, like, you know, like, moral issues and like the way that they do, like their values is very important to us. And then we started questioning whether or not we would continue, working with them. And then, you know, I'm asking you guys, you'll help me decide, right? Everyone gets to chip in and then we decide if we move things. no, but so it's a question that had risen up where we were like, okay, do we move this, you know, because we feel more comfortable working with someone else, but it's not going to be as local as it is right now. Yeah.
I think that local thing, it's also, and I think that that's really particularly, and this is maybe one of my things, in the UK, it's really important when we look at local that it's not nationalism, that it's actually local.
Definitely.
And what I found are really, you can look up on the map, you can, if you look up maps, and then you look for it as the crow flies map, and you'll get to Paris in half the time you'll get to Shetland, for example. So if we're talking about local, it might, it may also be a different country rather than...
It's true. I'm just going to say that, you know, for, so we're, as I said earlier, with Nurtured, we're working with Greenmount Spinnery. They're like 3 hours away from us.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the other mill that we work with in Canada is like 10 hours away. Mm-hmm. So then this one is much further. It reminded me, you know, like when you said nationalism, I think, you know, like where does your pride of local stand for when you're like, oh, this is for my country, or, you know, or like, this is for the people.
I mean, honestly, it comes down to marketing as well. Like, there is definite value in being able to say, you know, this is a Canadian product, spun in Canada, this is Wolf, all that sort of stuff. Like, that's also market value because people see that, and that's their tie to, and that's their kind of keyword association with ethical crafting and conscious crafting.
Well, and definitely. I think, yeah, they'll often then you understand that, you know, you're in a country that has a sort of a certain minimum wage or a certain standard of living or those things, even though in a lot of, you know, home crafting and piecework situations, there are definite ways of skirting those.
Oh, I think it can happen in any country, I would believe.
That's why I would give you permission. Like, what I would be more interested in, and there's just the geeky side, but if you chose to go someplace else, I would love to know, okay, fibers from here, it was scoured here, and this is why.
Yeah.
It was scoured, it was spun here, and this is why. So even if it was, you know, this is a Canadian product, but we had it spun in Pennsylvania. But if you have a compelling and honest reason why.
Definitely.
Like, I'd love something where it shows real intention in every decision. And
definitely. So. Yeah, it always, you know, that's the way that we work. And then I was kind of sad to think that, oh, like, maybe we'll have to let this go. You know, because it doesn't fall into what we're doing anymore just because, you know, we don't agree on a couple of things. But I think it's still very, so then in that term, I'm thinking maybe, no, it's not, it's still local, but I mean, to me, it's even more conscious. Mm. It's not more conscious, but I mean, I'll explain to you why I'm doing this and then you'll understand and you'll, you'll be happy.
like the morality.
And that's it, exactly.
And companionship and kinship.
You have a chat with them and be like, so, this thing isn't quite working.
Yeah. Oh, that happens many times.
I think transparency in that sense is hugely important. And I think if you can explain why, then people will be on board with it. But I think I used to work in organic food kind of production and stuff. And, you know, there was always a lot of discussion for growers about certification or not certification because it's a really big process to go through. Massive expenses, but also a lot of paperwork, a lot of time, and some growers just are not able to do that. But the problem with that is then it allows you have to. It has to. If you're not doing certification, you have to. You have to really be able to rely on your transparency, because otherwise people can just very subtly manipulate. And we're all kind of prone to that. We're all compliant and or complicit. You know, when something feels good, we kind of sometimes we don't scratch the surface to really know what's going on. And I don't really know how you measure that or how you embody it, but I think in any industry or any community, there's a it's a slippery slope.
Can I add something? it just reminded me of I'll put something out there, but you know, like you said, transparency, and I think sometimes also. Hold on, how can I put this? So there's this, okay, I'll explain the situation, you'll see where I'm going. So as I said, you know, we right now we're working with a Canadian mill, and then there are other andiers in Quebec where I'm from that states on their label that they use a Quebec company, you know, like they that their yarn comes from Quebec. And then for us, you know, talking always about how where we get our yarns and that we're really thinking about all this, people are always, I get more and more questions recently about, oh, then why don't you use the yarn from Quebec like other people? And then it's very hard for me to answer, because I know that the yarn dyers that use those yarns, they truly believe in their mind that the yarn comes from Quebec, because that's what they're told. But I mean, for you know, when you think about it, it's actually impossible. So, you know, like that company is based in, so what happens is when you call them is they say, we have a, you know, like our office is in Montreal. And then you ask, oh, do you have a mill? So you know, like I actually called them and I was like, what is that? And then they're like, oh, well, we have a mill in Quebec. And you know, it's on the South Shore. And I'm like, oh, really? Okay. And then what do you guys do? Oh, we have all kinds of yarns and all that. So then it means that if I go visit your mill, like, I'll see my yarn being spun there. It's like, oh, no, we do yarn for fire retardant things. Oh, cool. Okay. So then, you know, your office is here, and then do you have a mill here? Yes. And then, you know, like, but the wool yarn is made elsewhere. And then it's a really good marketing point, and then people are kind of, like, happy to use it, you know? So, yeah, we have to ask questions. I think that's the thing. You have to ask questions.
Which is hard, because, I mean, that that puts so much more time and effort into the situation. And it's like, mm-hmm. at some point, you just want to knit a goddamn sweater. But yeah, it's so useful and so worthwhile to just take a minute to step back and find the people that have been transparent and have done the research, because I think finding the people who value the product means that you're going to have a product that you value and that you want to work with.
And I think also people want to trust you, you know, and you want people to trust you and you want to be transparent, and we're, you know, like it's part of us to be this way. But I understand that for knitters, you know, like the informations that you get are the ones that the companies are giving you. So then, you know,
we tried to do our best.
No, they would never lie. The problem is that we all want to hear a good story, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know?
That's true.
And it's heartbreaking when, oh, yeah.
And it's the story that sells. That's the thing. It's like, if you don't have the story, it doesn't work. So inventing a story is sometimes a really helpful way to get something to sell.
If it was spun by nuns in a water-powered mill, you know, just down from angels and butterflies, like.
Surprised there isn't yarn spun by nuns in a water.
There is a yarn spun in the Swiss Alps that in a water-powered mill, which is
just no nuns.
Close.
So
no
we
nuns.
Could, we
no
could
nuns.
Bring
None.
Some nuns.
Ba-dunk-sh, thank you.
It's going to become a habit.
You're quick.
Do we continue on that? No.
Anybody?
You want to call us to order? Okay, sorry.
I'm leaving.
So if we're thinking about, if we go with that sweater now, that we're making that sweater. So say we've picked that yarn. What sweater do we pick?
You just download a free pattern on the internet, you know?
Ow, stop it.
I know where you live, Clara.
Yeah, she does. We could build a tunnel between our two houses.
That's. I have controversial opinions about that. Can I share controversial opinions?
Can she share?
Is that okay? Is anyone going to hurt me
about free patterns or
about no? Just about patterns in general. Yeah. I think there's elements of sustainability that we are missing in huge amounts in garment construction at the moment, and in pattern development, in the way that we make our garments, in the yarn that we use, in the way that we structure them. It's not a piece of slow fashion. It's something that's going to lose its shape. Like, so to be bluntly specific, something made out of finger wash, super weight, no, I'm sorry, finger wash? Super wash fingering weight, or four ply, at a loose gauge without any structure, so a top-down raglan. It's potato chip knitting, it's fantastic, it makes use of the beautiful yarns that are out there, but it's not something that's going to stand in your wardrobe for years. The yarn's going to stretch. It has no structure. The yarn's going to pill. It's not going to be something that you're going to be able to see look amazing year to year. And I am fully aware of the hypocrisy on that I'm currently wearing a superwash merino fingering weight sweater, but it's seamed and there's structure, and I've worn it for 4 years straight, and I love it. But it's, I think that we have some education to do in terms of garment construction, in terms of gauge, in terms of the right yarn for the right project, to make sure that what we actually create as knitters does our work justice and lasts for as long as the time we put into it deserves. You know, so I think that that's something that I'm really looking to work more on in the future, is to make sure that what I do with construction does the yarn justice and will last and will be something that will stand up for a while. So I was in Shetland a few weeks ago, and we saw stuff in the museum that had been knit and spun 60 years ago. It was pristine because they did the right yarn and the right project and the right structure all together, and it holds up. And you're not going to see a superwash merino fingering weight loose gauge sweater getting handed down through the ages and hanging up in a museum in 20 years.
They may have even unpicked it and frogged it and re-knitted it, you know, and it's held up to that as well.
I think it's very interesting what you're bringing up, because for us, it also applies like on the yarn level. Recently, we just released a new sock yarn And it's American Merino, eye twist, and we really put a lot of thought into it, thinking about sock knitting. And then we're super excited and we're launching it. And then I don't want to scare you people, you can go and buy it. But I mean, like, we actually had a hard time at first because people were not understanding, like, why we were doing this in the terms of, I'm saying, you know what, I really thought about you knitting socks and I want them to last forever. And this is what this is meant to be doing. And then what we got is, it's not soft. So then I was like, well, it is
enough. Not the point.
You know, like, that's another thing, like, with yarn, and then, you know, you're like, oh, it's not as soft as I would have wanted to be. And soft is really good for certain projects, by the way. But, I mean, you know, like, for use and, you know, like, really? Thinking about the project that you want to be doing. And then, you know, like, so this yarn is for your feet, you know, and, I mean, you could do shawls or other things with it, but, I mean, it's to walk in and for them to be... good for a very long time. If you want to wear it, I mean, it's meant for comfort, but I mean, it's not as soft, and then it has a purpose. So then, like, for us in yarn terms, it's something that we run into sometimes, yeah. Too. Yeah.
And you've also had lots of discussions with superwash versus non-superwash, right? Like, that's been something that you've thought about. I know we've had a conversation about this, yes, a while ago.
So with, you know, I think that with end dyeing, I don't know how it is with you with natural dyes, I'm sorry, I don't even know if you have superwash yarn.
I don't dye superwash, but I've certainly have in the past, like in trials,
yes,
and stuff.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I think that, so going with consciousness, you know, there are different processes of superwash, and then there are different things, like there are many things to consider. And I, in my heart, in the way that I see my knitting family and the knitting industry, I really hope and I see people doing good and like going forward. You know, good superwash method.
Like the eco-wash,
exactly,
method, yeah.
And then, you know, like, I want to believe that that's what people want to do. And I think that with end dyeing, anyway, for us, you know, with the dyes that we are using, when you think about who wants to buy that and you know, what is it known for, like the colors, the bright colors, you can go around it if you want, but I mean, there's a part of that that's like associated with superwash.
So you mean the color that you get when you're dyeing on a superwash is different than the color you'll get if you dye on a...
Definitely. And then I think that people in their mind associate like and dyed, you know, bright colors on a superwash being vibrant because you're like, oh, it's different. And then, you know, like the method have changed so much that honestly, you know, when we pick the place where the superwash is done, the people that we work with, there are good methods now that can be used. And, you know, honestly, there are, you know, the superwash that we use, I feel good about. So then, you know, like, what I want to say is I think that the companies, you know, want to go forward that, and I wish that in the future, you know, it's all going
to
be.
And we may
like
also
that.
Reach a stage where we've learned how to wash sweaters properly, and we might not need to wash anymore. From the
no.
I mean, is there a, you know, as we watch our community, like what they like change? Yeah. How?
Well, I think that part, that not responsibility, opportunity, really does fall in the hands of the designers, because now we have this whole generation of designers who are not beholden to any yarn company as their employer, and you can choose. Yeah, well,
it's not terrifying.
No
at all.
Longer,
yeah. Responsibility.
They're completely independent. They have no security whatsoever. But you now can choose which yarn is right for which project. And so, with designers and patterns, you could pick the crunchy. I will not say the scratchy word. You can pick the crisp and the crunchy and the vibrant and robust, the rye bread, toothy
texture.
You can pick it and explain why you chose it and why. I mean. Because if we kind of have this kind of popularity thing going on, so use it responsibly, and you can totally drive.
But then, going back to my original point, that goes back into economic situations, because often the crunchier ones are the more expensive, small batch limited edition ones, so my pattern might then not be as accessible to the average knitter. So you get into that dilemma, again, paradox, this whole conversation's paradox.
Can you show it in two? In your abundant spare time?
In my abundant spare time, and my millions of simple knitters.
Well, no, I think I've thought about that with the way that you put out yarn, where you put out these amazing, you know, traceable, thoughtful yarns. But they'd be really hard to offer pattern support.
Impossible.
Because you couldn't, you know, you're not, by nature, if you do a one-off batch of yarn, you can't, you get it and then it goes out to knitters. There isn't the time for that to sit and go to a designer who then sits with it and makes something with it. And actually, in a really, if you got a really tiny batch, giving somebody 10 skeins in order to make a sweater is actually quite a huge chunk of that small batch.
Can I just say, Clara did do that for me. She gave me 10 skeins of corn. Thank you, Clara.
That's love, right?
But it really, it's a horrible business plan. Don't do it. As soon as you figure everything out, you like break the mold and go on to your next problem. But
yeah.
In terms of the finance?
Well, no, I think I was just thinking of just as something to kind of bring up, because I'm not sure if that's something that specifically, you know, that may be something that we know on the, you know, because we have chats and things, and I don't know if on the other side, like, at this stage, we've had this amazing thing with Ravelry that it makes it really clear, like, substitution has become a really, really useful thing, but there are still knitters who will only knit the pattern in the thing that it said, ideally in the color that it's in the picture, right? Yeah. So there is that gap of going, oh, you just, Clara's got a yarn. Oh my gosh, what can I do with it? Oh, there's no pattern for it. Like, just maybe to just have,
I try to, like, show swatches or ideas. I'm kind of being mean in that I'm forcing people to, like, no, I'm not going to give you every, like, you got to think here. But it's a good kind of thinking. And speaking of economics, I just wanted to plant a seed of an idea that I had. Okay, you know how some people have wine clubs? I don't know if they do that here in the UK. But you pool your money, and once a month somebody hosts a gathering, and it's your responsibility to find the most esoteric and bizarre yarn, or wine or a couple of wines, and you sip it, and you think deep thoughts, and you discuss. Well, you could do exactly the same thing with yarn and have a swatching club and, like, not even tell people what it is in your whole evening. Well, of course, you have to have wine with it.
Well, yeah, no, but what you can do is you compare. We've done, with Anna's at Wild & Woolly has done this, where she's paired the cheese that you eat came from the same sheep that made the wool, and or like the region where the cider came from was right around the fields. So like you can make it a whole, like, all the places, all the things evening.
Oh my god. Wow.
And then you could even, like, you can even dye it with the colors that are there. Yeah, totally. Right? Like,
I think people are becoming, I think as knitters we're all becoming much more engaged and interested and educated about it, but there are always going to be people who just want to knit it the way it is. And so, you know, it's a...
But there is that, there is that togetherness of it. But I also think, like, that natural dyeing is another perfect example of it's not going to be the same, and that's, like, inherently part of it. Like, that's the beauty of it.
You have to make a celebration of that rather than it becoming a limitation of it. And that kind of takes a leap of consciousness, I think, as a dyer, but also as consumers, you know?
Yeah.
I haven't found the answer to that quite yet.
But the scale too, like, does that, it's inherently a kind of small batch thing too, right? Like,
I mean, I'm tiny scale, and I'm only just starting now as a, you know, to do small production. And I can't really imagine ever being big. And I think we were talking just really briefly before about the challenges of natural dyeing versus, what do we call it, chemical dyeing? I mean, what is non-natural
synthetic
dyes? Synthetic dyes.
Because I was going to say, you know, before we, as I told you, you know, we recently we switched the dyes that we are using. And then before we were using acid dyes. And then, you know, when you think about wool dyeing, you're always thinking acid dyeing. But then recently we switched to fiber reactive. So then I don't know. Like, chemical. Is that a scary word? Because sometimes it's not. Could be. I don't know.
Well, I think reactive dyeing versus acid dyeing, they both sound pretty...
Like, yeah.
Like, sound pretty, like, comic booky.
I like that, reactive. That means that your skein's going to, like, slap you back. I like it.
That's it. Yeah.
Those needles? Screw you.
What were you going to say?
I think... Yeah, I was going to say that I imagine I'll always be small scale. I mean, I see somebody like Christine... Is it VR? I don't know how you...
VR.
VR. I mean, she's the biggest...
A verb for keeping warm in Oakland,
she's kind of, I think,
California.
In terms of scale, is she the biggest natural dyer around? Like, does anybody know
Shilastair does natural dyes.
Yeah. Right?
Oh, yeah.
So maybe on a similar par. Mm. you know, they're much bigger than I am, but they're still tiny compared to even other indie dyers, but also like larger companies. And I'm not really sure of the scale, but I'm certainly finding already that there's real challenges in natural dyeing that means that it's not just an easier, more natural option than synthetic dyes, you know. And it just shows you, I think, that there's, you know, issues in any kind of production. So, for example, for me, I live in a flat, I dye in my kitchen, and water, we take a lot more water. Well, for me anyway, I use a lot more water to rinse my yarn to get the rinse water to run clear than I think any acid dyes or reactive dyes that I've ever tried. So just for me alone, I think, wow, if I ever move back to Australia, mm-hmm. I would really, really have to consider continuing doing this or how I would do it. Because even in Scotland, I feel like the water consumption is huge. But in Australia, we're in a drought kind of pretty much permanently. So, and I imagine California, I'm really interested with Christine, like how she manages that. And
maybe she showers with her yarn.
Totally.
And double up. Totally. She's always like slightly tinted.
Say that again?
She's always slightly tinted.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've started to use my dye baths over and over again, like to use to get exhaust colours, and then to dye them with another colour, so to get complex shades from minimum numbers of dye baths, mm-hmm. so that I don't have to constantly be just changing my dye bath and replenishing the water there. But, you know, I think that's not such an issue for you. So
I we think about it still because, you know, it uses, I mean, just using water, mm-hmm. I'm always like, no. So, you know, like, again, just as you do, you know, we try to, whenever it's possible for us to reuse it or, like, cool it down or, like, bring the pH back or whatever. So then that's what we're trying we're always trying to think about the best way to, like, not use as much. Yeah. And then, you know, something I'm just throwing out there. Also, it depends on, you know, as you said, it depends on where you are, because you're saying, oh, even here I don't really feel good about it. And then if I was to go back to Australia... For us, it's the same, you know, being in Canada and having, like, filtration systems and the water going through it anyway. I'm not saying that I'm dumping it everywhere. But, you know, like, you, like, for, so it's much different for us to use more, let's say, than for another place to use as much. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that there are those things where we also have to just stop and go, we're doing an amazing thing. We're making things ourselves. Yeah. Like, the consciousness that we bring to that for ourselves, I think once you've made a sweater or a pair of socks, you'll never, ever buy a pair in the same way again. Yeah. And I think that when somebody sees us making something, mm-hmm. it lets them know that that's possible. Mm-hmm. And I think that knock-on effect, it's so easy to forget that side, that what we do, I think, is totally inherently amazing and good and talks about the right things. It talks about making things based on community. It's about passing on skills, which have a long history of being passed on through generosity. It talks, so in a way, to somewhat remember that before we get so bogged down with the, like, oh, and we could do this better and we could do that better.
Mm-hmm. But I think every single person who knits is continually striving for better in everything they do. They come take classes, they learn new things. It's inherently part of who we are. So it's yes, I totally 100% agree with you, but I also think every single one of us...
Little
pat on the back, but also a little bit of a kick in the butt.
Yeah.
At the same time, like, we're all people that
but that kick strive and crave like to move forward. Constant, and I guess as I'm trying to conscious that people may want to go outside and go get a bit more yarn and things.
We should probably
shut
up now.
In terms of the timing, because we could keep on.
No, I
want to
keep talking.
Like,
I want to keep talking.
To think that go out thinking like, what we're doing is good, like, and that in that there are so many ways that we can be super duper extra conscious about what we do. I was thinking about toilets when you were talking about water. I was thinking about that moment where, the moment when we use grey water to flush our loos, then maybe we need to worry about the yarn we use. Mm. But right now, we use drinking water to flush toilets. Mm-hmm. So if we decide to use some of that drinking water for dyeing yarn, maybe on the scale of things, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot less people dyeing yarn than flushing loos.
Definitely. And, you know, I think in the end, like we're, regardless of the level where we're at, you know, we're all trying to do our best as knitters, yeah. as, you know, in the industry and all that. And we all have to feel good about what we're doing. And I think it was interesting in the question that you sent us also, you know, you were asking what do you do consciously to support like the knitting and like support the knitting community and not be over consuming. And, you know, it's like to create new knitters and, you know, to get people interested in fiber. Things so that people get, you know, more knitters. So then you bring friends with you yeah. to these
bring
things.
Friends. Yeah.
Yeah.
So those of you who are feeling super duper conscious about you saw something you wanted to get, feel free to sneak out. If anybody would like to ask questions, now would be the time to do that.
What about the role of virtual yarn store? Because they'd love to stock organic numbers.
Is the knitting community sustainable without local yarn stores? Not the community I want to be a part of. No, I really don't. I feel like local yarn stores, it's not just a grocery store where you go to buy six onions to cook a meal. It's a community space mm-hmm. where you go, and it's a cradle-to-the-grave relationship that they offer you, that they're going to help you choose a pattern and support you when things go wrong and celebrate at the end of it what beautiful work that you did. You can't get that in many other ways and that intense like yeah. face-to-face way.
And like, yeah. I was just gonna, you know, like I was just gonna add for us being end dyers, and I mean we all have a different business model, but you know we made the conscious choice actually to do mostly wholesale to support local yarn shops because I truly believe in the community that they bring, and that's why I made that choice to build like to set up our business model around this other than selling it ourselves. And also, I mean, it brings other, you know, it's a different way of doing things, but then, you know, like some, yeah. so it's something to think about.
And yeah. I think you were potentially also asking like, what happens if your customers only want to come in and buy really cheap acrylic yarn from you as a local yarn shop?
That's what they can afford, right?
I think that, you know, you grow up together, right? Like, I think that it's a teamwork thing. So it's an education on both sides. At the same time, if like your yarn local yarn shop only sold stuff you don't like, you'd actually, if you're feeling community minded, it's probably good to go and have a chat with them and say, hey, look, I'd love it if you stocked this type of thing, because then I would come and buy it from you, not from the internet. Mm-hmm. In the same way that as a local yarn shop, if you only have acrylic and then maybe you have, you know, this one locally dyed organic yarn, like in a little basket, and somebody comes in and sees that and will get that, then you can see how to grow from that. But it does take yeah. it being there and being possible. And I think that we've got an odd situation where I think the online is having, like, how do we as knitters, how do we as shoppers support our local yarn stores? Because they are so essential. They're such essential hubs of the community, and we can't just use them as libraries where we go and look at a pattern book and then go and get it for £2 or £3 less, you know? And we can't only buy at festivals, yeah. if I can say that too.
I think that's a huge like thing.
It's,
yeah.
You know, it's a funny thing. Like, we got to be careful that we spread where we get stuff, yeah. because if we only buy it on holiday and only buy it on a special, like, event thing, that doesn't help them tick over, and yet they're the people that we go to when we're stuck, because they're right there. And sometimes YouTube videos don't give you all the answers, or you've watched 10 of them and you still don't bloody get it. So, like, I do think that an intrinsic part of crafting consciously is working out ways that we have local communities that are fed into and supported by a kind of global online, but at the hub of that local is, if we're lucky, is a vibrant yarn shop.
I think it's so important to remember, right?
Because we also get into this point of like, I know in London they all closed for a really long time. There weren't any. And I talk to a lot of people who go, well, my only option is online. And I think that this is kind of a global problem. But then this thing happens where you kind of go, you need to be the best one in your area. And like all the other ones are competition. And I kind of feel like if we were so many, like if you look back, there would have been a yarn shop in every village and in every neighborhood of every big town. And to sort of think like at some point again, we could be enough people to support that. And rather than feel that competition, that could be, that is also an option.
It's been lovely to see in Edinburgh the, you know, the craft crawl that happens where, I know I don't know the politics in the knitting community in Edinburgh, I'm sure things go on, but seeing all the yarn shops work together and now this year the craft shops, you know, where it becomes an event where they work together, they all have slightly different product, but they support each other and then, you know, it creates a more of a vibe and a buzz and a community than if they all do their own thing, which is a little bit more the case in other places.
And I know that very often Yarn Shop Day is the single biggest day for yarn shops. So it's still, even for a local yarn shop, it takes an event like that to remind us to go in and get something from them. Yeah. So I guess unintentionally we've come around to one of my favourite sort of conscientious things. Remembering... Yeah.
Well, then you can't replicate the feeling that you get when you walk into a really good yarn store. Yeah. I mean, online, that's sort of like, you know, in a pinch, if you want a pencil, you can blah, blah, blah. But, like, to go into a really good yarn store, the smell, even the kind of muted sound, because all the wool muffles the sound, and the colors, and you can just, like, roll around. So there should be an admission fee. Maybe that would be...
Well, I think so much more of what brings people to knit is, it's not about the knitting, really. It's about, like, I've worked in yarn shops and people come in and sometimes you can see them hesitating at the door. Mm-hmm. You know, they're nervous. They might be going through a really hard time in their life and they think, I want to do something nice, or they're having kids or, you know, some other big celebration or big, really tough time. And you're just facilitating an opening in a community. The knitting is secondary, and so... Mm-hmm. Having the yarn shop, that doesn't happen online. So it's, you know, it's profound. Yeah. And we're responsible for that as people in that community. So.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for being here.
Well, thanks again to all of the knitters who were in the round talking whilst seated in a semicircle. So just a little sort of visual there just at the end. Yeah. Yes, thanks again to Anna for hosting and to all our participants. So Clara, Bristol, Julia and Julie. And thanks to you guys for listening. We should be back next month with a more traditional style podcast.
A Christmas style podcast, maybe?
Could it be us singing a Christmas song out of tune?
Oh, I hope so. That's what people have come to know and love, right?
Oh boy. We'll release an album one day.
Yeah. Yes, all the thanks. Mm-hmm. We'll see you soon. Take care, Pomcats. We love you.
Bye!
Podcast is produced by Lydia Gluck and Sophie Scott. Lots of help from Eli Block, who created the original music for the show. For more Eli-related music, go to goodgirlandthebadtimes.com.
Thanks, as always, to Megan Fernandez, co-creator and editor of Pom Pom Quarterly. And thanks also to the lovely Amy and Gail.
Thank you to our panel members, Clara Parks, Bristol Ivy, Judah Billings and Julie Asselin. And of course, for Anna Maltz for being our host.
Of course, a big thank you to all you Pom Pom buyers, subscribers and listeners. You can buy your copy of the magazine and subscribe too at our online shop, pompommag.com/shop.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and why not leave a review? Send any feedback or ideas to podcast@pompommag.com. And don't forget to keep in touch with us via the podcast group on the Pompom Ravelry Forum.